Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah chapter 39, which I will call the Fall of Jerusalem. We start now in Jeremiah 39, verses 1 through 2. This is how Jerusalem was taken. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army and laid siege to it. And on the 9th day of the 4th month of Zedekiah's 11th year, the city wall was broken through. Now here we have all the dates that surround the taking of Jerusalem by Babylon in 586 BC. We probably need to point out that Jeremiah must have written this after the fall. Obviously, this was not a prophecy. This is history now. Well, let's look at the dates. First of all, when was the siege begun by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon? In the 9th year of Zedekiah. Zedekiah ruled from 597 to 586, so the 9th year is 588. It was in the 10th month, and then on the 4th month of the 11th year, which is 586, but it was in the 4th month, not the 10th month, that was 18 months later, the city wall was broken through. And we're going to see later on, a month later, in the 5th month of the 11th year, 586, the city was burnt down. Now, the time of the beginning of the siege, the 9th year of Zedekiah, in the 10th month, matches exactly with our other biblical account, 2 Kings 25:1, in the 9th year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army. They laid siege to the city and built a siege wall against it all around. That's in 2 Kings. We also read in Jeremiah 52, verse 4, in the 9th year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army. They laid siege to the city and built a siege wall all around it. So there's no problem with the dates there. There is, however, another view which says the siege didn't last 18 months, but rather lasted 30 months. This is from a footnote in Wikipedia. The author of this article quotes an Abraham Malamat in 1968, he wrote an article called The Last Kings of Judah and the Fall of Jerusalem, an historical chronological study, and I'm not going to get into the details of that. I'm not even going to read it, because it's for Bible geeks, those who lust after PhDs in New Testament study or Old Testament studies. But we're going to take the 18-month length of the siege as being accurate. It began in the 10th month, that's Tevet, December, January, that's the ecclesiastical year, I'm assuming. And then the siege, after having begun in the winter, ended in the summertime in the 4th month in 586, so the 4th month being Tammuz, which is June or July. Again, that's the ecclesiastical year, not the civil year. And so now that we have our dates established, we can go now to verse 3 of Jeremiah 39. Then all the officials of the king of Babylon came and took seats in the middle gate. Nergal-Sharezer of Samgar, Nebo-Sarsakim, a chief officer, Nergal-Sharezer, a high official, and all the other officials of the king of Babylon. Well, we'll talk about these individual officials in just a minute, but first let's see where they took their seats. This is after the wall had been broken down, and so they managed to get inside the city. They took their seats in the middle gate. Well, where's the middle gate? Of course, nobody knows exactly, and they never do. When gates are mentioned in the Old Testament, confusion reigns. Well, I'm going to give you some suggestion. Here's one option. Jerusalem had three walls, and this gate was in the middle wall, and thus it was called the middle gate. Well, that's just a speculation. Here is a diagram from a website called generationword.com, and the map has the northern wall of Jerusalem intersected by a gate called the middle gate, right there in the middle. Well, wherever it was, this was probably the chief gate where the Babylonian princes and officials placed their seats in triumph as victors. And by doing so, they fulfilled Jeremiah's prophecy, which he made in chapter 1, verse 15. Jeremiah said this, "Indeed, I am about to summon all the clans and kingdoms of the north. This is the Lord's declaration. They will come, and each king, or each official, will set up his throne at the entrance to Jerusalem's gates. They will attack all her surrounding walls and all the other cities of Judah. But they will set up their thrones at the entrance to Jerusalem's gates." Jeremiah sounded like he was prophesying that the subordinate nations who were fighting with the king of Babylon, like Syria, for example, might have had a throne there at the middle gate. But at any rate, the Babylonians have won, and Jeremiah's prophecy is just about to completely come true. City wasn't burnt down yet, but it was taken. Now, some of these officials at the gate, there were four of them mentioned here, Nergal Sharezer. Well, actually, Nergal Sharezer is mentioned twice. So let's deal with that first. Why are there two Nergal Sharezers? The Cambridge Commentary says the second Nergal Sharezer is probably an erroneous repetition of the first Nergal Sharezer. Ellicott and Barnes, on the other hand, say no, there were two generals that happened to have the same name. Now, Barnes got an interesting comment about the second Nergal Sharezer. He says that this man was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar and probably his vice-regent during his 7 years of madness, Nebuchadnezzar's 7 years of madness. 2 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death, Nergal, who Barnes says is Nergal Sharezer, Nergal murdered evil Merodach, Nebuchadnezzar's son, and seized the crown, but after a reign of 4 years was slain in battle against Cyrus when disputing with Cyrus the crown of Media. Well, if that's so, then this chief officer had a glorious future ahead of him as emperor of Babylon, Nergal Sharezer. Of course, I don't know if Barnes is right. I'm not an expert on this. I just take his word for it that he might be right. Now, the first Nergal Sharezer of Samgar, that's the NIV translation. Other translations have it, Nergal Sharezer, Samgar, being a fourth official. Now, Nebo Sarsakim is called a chief officer in the NIV, but he is the Rabsaris in the Holman Christian Study Bible and other translations. The Rabsaris, I love these titles of Mesopotamian officials. Remember, the Rabsaris is the same name given to the official that was mocking Hezekiah outside the walls of Jerusalem in 701 when the Assyrians were attacking Jerusalem. The name means chief eunuch. At any rate, we've got a Rabsaris here, which is a high-level official. And then we've got the second Nergal Sharezer, who is also a high official, a chief officer, high official, as the NIV has it. But this second high official is the Rabmag, or the Rabmag, which means chief magician. That's par for the course for a Babylonian official, I guess, a chief magician. These officials are sitting there in the middle gate, and the time of reckoning had come for the city of Jerusalem. Now, notice that these officials had idolatrous pagan names. Nergal, which is the first part of Nergal Sharezer, Nergal was a god of Babylon. We read in 2 Kings 17:30, the men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth. Cuth is a prominent city in the Babylonian Empire. The men of Cuth made Nergal. So Nergal was an idol, a Babylonian idol. And Nebo-Sarsakim has a name that contains a Babylonian god within it, Nebo. If we look at Isaiah 46, verse 1, first part of the verse, Bel crouches, Nebo cowers. Those are two famous Babylonian gods. So here we have men with idolatrous names at the head of an idolatrous pagan army conquering over God's holy city of Jerusalem, the city that had his name on it. Remember in the law, you're not going to offer sacrifices unless you do it in the city that I tell you. And now the fruits of the Jews' idolatry have finally been produced. We go now to Jeremiah 39, verses 4 through 7. When Zedekiah, king of Judah, and all the soldiers saw them, saw all those Babylonian officials, Zedekiah and his soldiers fled. They left the city at night by way of the king's garden through the gate between the two walls and headed toward the Arabah. But the Babylonian army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. They captured him and took him to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, at Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he pronounced sentence on them. There at Riblah, the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes and also killed all the nobles of Judah. Then he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. Now there are a lot of geographical place names in this passage, and we'll get to them in a minute. First of all, in verse 4, how did Zedekiah and his soldiers see these officials in the middle gate? Probably from an observation tower. They probably saw the walls breached. Zedekiah is probably in the south of the city now as the Babylonians came in through the north. As soon as they saw the walls breached, they realized that their time was up, that they were toast, and so they fled. Now, they could have held the southern part of the city, Zion, a little bit longer. Remember, Zion is, first of all, it's surrounded by valleys, and then you have the Ophel at the northern end of it. The Babylonians would have had to break through all that, but they didn't have any food. The Jews did not. And so they decided they better take off. Now, superficially, that wasn't a bad decision, given the fact that the Babylonians were not likely to be merciful. However, we need to point this out. Zedekiah ignored Jeremiah's promise of leniency to Zedekiah if Zedekiah would surrender. In our last chapter, verse 17, Jeremiah 38, we read this. Jeremiah therefore said to Zedekiah, "This is what the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel says. If indeed you surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then you will live. The city will not be burned down, and you and your household will survive." If Zedekiah had just listened to Jeremiah, he would have lived. Well, he did live, but he wouldn't have been blinded and taken off to Babylon. The city would not have been burnt down. But Zedekiah didn't listen to Jeremiah. Jeremiah told Zedekiah that in the very last meeting that Jeremiah had with Zedekiah at the third entrance of the temple, whatever that third entrance is. Now Zedekiah and his soldiers fled the city at night. Josephus says the city was actually taken at night. I don't know if that's true or not. If it was taken at night, I don't see how Zedekiah could have seen that it happened from an observation tower. Of course, the word could have passed through the city by messengers at night. At any rate, he takes off by way of the king's garden, that is at the very south of Mount Zion in Jerusalem. It's marked on almost all the maps at the south end of Mount Zion. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says the gate to the king's garden was between the upper city above going down to the garden, and that gate was appropriated to the kings alone. Stairs led down from Mount Zion to the king's garden below. King's Garden is mentioned in Nehemiah 3:15. Shallan, son of Kolhozeh, ruler over the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate, and the fountain gate is on the southern wall. This man rebuilt the fountain gate and roofed it. Then he installed its doors, bolts, and guards. He also made repairs to the wall of the Pool of Shelah, that's the Pool of Siloam, famous place, which was near the King's Garden. So all down here, the fountain gate, the King's Garden, the Pool of Siloam, where the famous water from the Gihon Spring through Hezekiah's tunnel ended up in the Pool of Siloam. All of that is at the southern end of Mount Zion, which is that little ridge going from Mount Moriah, where the temple was, all the way down running south till you get to the Valley of Ben-Hinnom at the southern end. And this little ridge, the city of Zion, Mount Zion, surrounded by valleys on the west and east, on the west by the Tyrrhenian Valley, on the east by the Kidron Valley. So Zedekiah went through or by way of the king's garden. Somewhere down there, there was a gate between two walls. There were two walls at the southern end of the city. How can a gate be between two walls? This is my speculation. I didn't read this anywhere. Take it with a grain of salt. The gate could have been on the inner wall, and then the overhanging gate structure. All these gates, of course, had awnings and roofs over them. Sometimes there were rooms above the gate structure. That gate structure could have protruded out from the first wall into the space between the two walls. Or it could have been a gate on a pathway between the two walls, although I don't know why there would be a gate on a pathway. That's a dumb speculation. That's mine. Just forget that one. I suspect it is the big gate structure. We think of a gate as just a narrow thing, but this thing was probably a big structure. So at any rate, Zedekiah went through the two walls, through that gate, and headed toward the Arabah. Now, the Arabah is that long depression, that valley, if you will. It runs from the Sea of Galilee, actually north of the Sea of Galilee a little bit, but let's just say from the Sea of Galilee, from the southern end of it, all down the Jordan River Valley until the Jordan River gets to the Dead Sea. And then, once you get to the south of the Dead Sea, the Arabah Valley continues and goes all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, which then leads into the Red Sea. So this is a big, well-known geographical feature. And once you go out of the southern end of the city of Mount Zion in Jerusalem, you're going to be in the Arabah Valley. In verse 5, the Babylonian army pursued Zedekiah and his soldiers, not the whole army of Nebuchadnezzar, but some of the army went chasing after Zedekiah. Now, a question might arise, how did the Babylonian army know where to find Zedekiah? You had surrendering citizens everywhere who could have very easily have told the army, or the army could have gone to the palace, a logical place to go to. No king there, he's already fled, so they surmised the only way that Zedekiah could flee was to the south, because the Babylonians were in the north. Now we have a problem here in verse 5. The Babylonian army pursued Zedekiah and the soldiers, overtaking Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. Well, Jericho is to the north of Jerusalem, not to the south. How can that be? The answer is the plains of Jericho is the name that's used here for the Arab Valley, because Jericho was right on the Arab Valley, north of Jerusalem. Jericho's plains ran right on down to the Jordan River, which is in the Arab Valley. But the Arab Valley went a lot further south than Jericho, and it was in the Arab Valley south of Jerusalem that Zedekiah got caught. So Zedekiah is caught, and the army took Zedekiah to meet King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamath. Well, where is Riblah? Here's what Wikipedia says. The ancient town of Riblah, today a tell covered by a cemetery, not far from the town of Ribleh, R-I-B-L-E-H, pretty close, on the Syrian side of the border with Lebanon. In biblical times, Riblah was located on the northern frontier of the land of Canaan. Riblah was a city in Syria, basically, or Aram, as they called it back then. And, of course, the Syrian kingdoms up there were called Hamath. And there was a town, a city, called Hamath on the Orontes River, which is one of the major rivers in Lebanon, flowing from the middle of the country northward, then taking a westward bend and dumping into the Mediterranean Sea at the northern end of Lebanon. Hamath is up there in that area. So anyway, that's where Riblah is. Riblah is the same place where the Egyptian pharaoh Necho II arrested the Jewish king Jehoahaz in 609. We read in 2 Kings 23:33, Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him, that's Jehoahaz, who ruled for a few short months, 3 months in 609. He was Josiah's son, Josiah having just been killed at the Battle of Megiddo by Necho II. So Necho imprisoned Jehoahaz, whom the people of Judah had put on the throne. Necho didn't like him. And so Necho imprisoned Jehoahaz at Riblah in the land of Hamath, same place, to keep him from reigning in Jerusalem. And later on, we know he took him down to Egypt. So Riblah is a place where kings were captured in the history of Israel. That is its claim to fame. Now, we know Zedekiah was captured and taken to Riblah. How much of his soldiers were captured? Josephus says that most of the soldiers had fled Zedekiah, and only a few were remaining with Zedekiah when the Babylonians finally caught up with Zedekiah. That sounds reasonable. Now, in verse 6, at Riblah, Nebuchadnezzar slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah while Zedekiah's eyes were still in his head. That was so Zedekiah could see it, to torture him. What a terrible thing to happen, to watch your own sons get murdered right in front of you, or executed right in front of you. Now, the purpose of this was that there would be no legitimate contenders for the throne after the Babylonians left. Nebuchadnezzar was going to appoint the governor Gedaliah to rule the province of Judah, and he didn't want there to be kings trying to overthrow his governor, kings with a legitimate right to succession. So he killed him. And after he let Zedekiah watch it, he blinded Zedekiah. And that's so that Zedekiah could never claim to be a king again. And then he put bronze shackles on Zedekiah and took Zedekiah to Babylon, where Zedekiah died. Scripture doesn't say this, it says it in another place. But so much for Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, and so much for Judah. In verse 6 at Riblah, we also see that the nobles of Judah, not just Jerusalem, but of Judah, the leading citizens of the land, executed at Riblah. These were probably the nobles who advocated resistance to Babylon. Other nobles had previously surrendered, we're sure, and they were taken in captivity to Babylon. Now when Nebuchadnezzar put out Zedekiah's eyes and took Zedekiah to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar fulfilled two of Jeremiah's prophecies. In Jeremiah 34, Jeremiah had prophesied that Zedekiah would see the king of Babylon with his own eyes, and he would not die, and that he would go to Babylon. So let's read that, Jeremiah 34, verses 3 and 4. Jeremiah says, "You will not escape from his grasp." Jeremiah's talking to Zedekiah. "But you will surely be captured and handed over to him. You will see the king of Babylon with your own eyes." He did. "And Nebuchadnezzar will speak with you," or the king of Babylon, "he will speak with you face to face, and you will go to Babylon," and that happened also. Yet hear the promise of the Lord, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. This is what the Lord says concerning you. You will not die by the sword. Well, that's exactly what happened. So Jeremiah is a great prophet. We read in Ezekiel 12:13. This is God speaking about Zedekiah. I will spread my net for him, and he will be caught in my snare. I will bring him to Babylonia, the land of the Chaldeans, but he will not see it. The reason he can't see the land of the Chaldeans is because he's been blinded. And there in Babylonia he will die. All of these prophecies were fulfilled to the letter. Prophecies of Jeremiah and prophecies of Ezekiel. We go now to Jeremiah 39, verses 8 through 10. The Babylonians set fire to the royal palace and the houses of the people and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, carried into exile to Babylon the people who remained in the city, along with those who had gone over to him and the rest of the people. But Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, left behind in the land of Judah some of the poor people who owned nothing, and at that time he gave them vineyards and fields. Now the city was set on fire about a month after the walls were breached by the Babylonians, as I said earlier. How do we know that? Because we turn to Jeremiah 52, verses 12 through 13, and we read this. On the 10th day of the 5th month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, 605 is when Nebuchadnezzar started reigning. 19 years from that, the 19th year. 19 years taken from that, the 19th year, gets us to 586, which is the year that we're talking about here. And we read that Nebuzaradan entered Jerusalem as the representative of the king of Babylon. And Nebuzaradan, verse 13, burned the Lord's temple, the king's palace, all the houses of Jerusalem, and all the houses of the nobles. In other words, he torched the whole city, and he did that in 586. When in 586, verse 12 of Jeremiah 52 says, on the 10th day of the 5th month. And remember, in verse 2 of our current chapter, Jeremiah 39, it was in the 4th month of Zedekiah's 11th year, 586. So the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar is 586. The 11th year of Zedekiah is 586. Jeremiah 52 says the city was burnt in the 5th month of 586. And Jeremiah 39:2 says it was on the 4th month that the city was broken into. So the people of Jerusalem had a month before their city was destroyed while the Babylonians arranged things. Now, Nebuzaradan carried into exile all the people who remained in the city. That was probably the middle class type people, the artisans and such, along with those who had gone over to him. Those were the ones who had surrendered outright from the very beginning. And the rest of the people, that probably refers to people in all the other cities of Judah. So people of wealth, people who made the city go, they're all taken off into exile. The only people that are left behind are some of the poor people. And notice that it says some of the poor people who owned nothing. In other words, they were very poor. But Nebuzaradan gave them vineyards and fields of the people who had been exiled. Why did he do that? Why did he give the poor farmers land that belonged to the deportees? Well, so they would have a way to make a living. Why would Nebuzaradan care about that? As a matter of fact, why did Nebuzaradan leave the poor people in Jerusalem to start with? Why did he not take them all and let Jerusalem become like Carthage? Well, here's some speculations as to why Nebuzaradan left all the poor people. First of all, the poor people were of no use to the Babylonians. In fact, would probably be a burden to the Babylonians. How are they going to make a living in Babylon? Nebuzaradan had nothing to fear from the poor people. They're never going to rebel. They're too poor to rebel. And by leaving them in the country of Judah and giving them land, they would produce crops. They would produce wealth, which could be taxed by the Babylonians. And we also might point out that it might have been sort of just that these poor people got the land of the richer exiles, is because a lot of those rich people were probably treating the poor very badly. If I remember correctly, Jeremiah mentioned this in one of his earlier prophecies about how nasty the people of Jerusalem were acting. They were not carrying out justice, probably cheating the poor. We go now to Jeremiah 39, verses 11 through 14. Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had given these orders about Jeremiah through Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard. And here are the orders that Nebuchadnezzar gave to Nebuzaradan. Take him, take Jeremiah, and look after him. Don't harm him, but do for him whatever he asked. So Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, Nebuzaradan, a chief officer, a Rabsaris, Nergal-Sharezer, a high official, the Rabmag, of the Rabmag, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, and all the other officers of the king of Babylon sent and had Jeremiah taken out of the courtyard of the guard. They turned him over to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, to take him back to his home. So he remained among his own people. Now in verse 11, Nebuchadnezzar had given orders about Jeremiah that were quite favorable to Jeremiah. Do for Jeremiah whatever he wants. We're going to see later on that Jeremiah was given the option to stay in Judah or to go to Babylon, and Jeremiah chose to stay. Why was Nebuchadnezzar so favorable towards Jeremiah? Well, Jeremiah had been preaching for years that the Babylonians were going to win. That naturally is going to make Nebuchadnezzar happy. And so Nebuzaradan, accompanied by all these other officials, Nebushazban, Nergal-Sharezer, and all the other officers of Babylon, went and took Jeremiah out of the prison that was in the courtyard of the guard. Now, all of those officials coming all at once would seem to be an effort to give Jeremiah great honor. You wonder what the local Jews thought about that. These nasty Babylonians have come in. They're getting ready to, well, actually, they've already set fire to the whole city. And here they are giving honor to the prophet Jeremiah, who predicted that this was going to happen. Now, in verse 14, we have a harmonization problem. Verses 13 and 14 say that Nebuzaradan and his officials took Jeremiah out of the courtyard of the guard and turned him over to Gedaliah, the future governor of Babylon. The harmonization problem is presented by the first verse in Jeremiah 40, which reads this way. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, released him at Ramah. Released him at Ramah, but Jeremiah 39, verse 14, says that Nebuzaradan had Jeremiah taken out of the courtyard of the guard, which is the prison in the king's palace, Zedekiah's palace, right south and below the temple on the Temple Mount. Well, where was Jeremiah released from? And how do we harmonize the two passages? Well, here's how the pulpit commentary does it, and I think this is perfectly reasonable. The solution is simple. When Jerusalem was taken, non-combatants were taken up to Ramah, which is right north of the city. They were taken up there to await King Nebuchadnezzar's decision as to what to do with them. And so therefore, Jeremiah was taken out of the courtyard of the guard, and he was sent up to Ramah. Now, Jeremiah 39:14 doesn't say anything about him being taken up to Ramah, but it does say he was taken out of the courtyard of the guard. So Nebuzaradan had come to Jerusalem to deal with the city's fate. He discovers that Jeremiah is up at Ramah. Nebuzaradan has been told by King Nebuchadnezzar, treat him nice. So Nebuzaradan sends for Jeremiah, who was up at Ramah, and releases him, turns him over to Gedaliah. So in other words, Jeremiah 39:14 is a summary account. Jeremiah was taken out of the courtyard of the guard in Jerusalem, and he's released in Ramah. Now, the releasing in Ramah is not mentioned in Jeremiah 39:14, but the taking away from the courtyard of the guard is mentioned. And so if you take it that way, there's no contradiction at all. In other words, right in the middle of verse 14, some more action happened. Jeremiah 39:14, Nebuzaradan and the officials sent and had Jeremiah taken out of the courtyard of the guard, period. And then he's taken up to Ramah, is released, and then we continue at the end of the period in verse 14. They turned him over to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, after he was let loose from Ramah. That's easy to harmonize. Now, Jeremiah is turned over to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, to take him back to his home. Now, of course, the pronouns are ambiguous. To take who back to his home? Gedaliah back to his home? Or Jeremiah back to his home? What's this home? Option number one, it was Gedaliah's temporary dwelling place as governor. Pulpit commentator affirms that option. Option number two was the royal palace where Zedekiah used to live. The pulpit commentary denies that. If it was the royal palace that Gedaliah was going back to, or that Jeremiah is going back to, is not clear which of the two we're talking about here. But if it's the royal palace would have to still be standing, and we know that the city of Jerusalem had just been burnt. We would have to assume that this release of Jeremiah happened before the city was burnt down, which I guess is possible, but I don't think that's very likely. Third option is to what this home is that either Gedaliah or Jeremiah are being taken back to. The temple. Well, again, the temple got burnt down too, so pulpit commentary denies that. John Gill says it's Jeremiah going back to his house in Anathoth, north of Jerusalem, Well, the way the NIV sounds, it sounds like Jeremiah is given to Gedaliah, and Gedaliah takes Jeremiah back to Gedaliah's home, wherever that is, his temporary governor's place. Doesn't really matter. So he remained among his own people. That means Jeremiah remained among the Jews. Before we move on, I need to say something about Gedaliah. Gedaliah's father seems to be the same man who saved Jeremiah from death. We read in Jeremiah 26, verses 23 through 24, they brought Uriah out of Egypt. Now, Uriah was a prophet prophesying along the same lines as Jeremiah, and he got scared because his life was in danger, and so he fled to Egypt. And King Jehoiakim, a previous king, sent messengers to arrest Uriah in Egypt. These messengers got Uriah, took Uriah to King Jehoiakim, who executed him with the sword and threw his corpse into the burial place of the common people. But Ahikam, son of Shaphan, supported Jeremiah, so he was not handed over to the people to be put to death. Now we read here in Jeremiah 37 that Ahikam was Gedaliah's father. Gedaliah was the son of Ahikam. So Gedaliah's father had supported Jeremiah. Now Gedaliah becomes governor. That's very good, because he's now got a friendly person ruling the province of Judah now. Now, since Gedaliah was appointed to be governor of Judah by the Babylonians, Gedaliah must have previously deserted to the Babylonians. We read in chapter 40, verse 5, how Gedaliah ends up being the Babylonian governor of Judah. When Jeremiah had not yet turned to go, Nebuzaradan said to him, "Return to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon has appointed over the cities of Judah, and stay with him among the people, or go wherever you want to go." So we read in that verse, Jeremiah 40, verse 5, that Nebuchadnezzar had appointed Gedaliah. So he must have been friendly to the Babylonians. He must have deserted to them earlier. We go now to Jeremiah 39, 15 through 18, and we will finish this chapter. While Jeremiah had been confined in the courtyard of the guard, the word of the Lord came to him, "Go and tell Abed-Melech the Cushite, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. I am about to fulfill my words against this city through disaster, not prosperity. At that time they will be fulfilled before your eyes." God's words would be fulfilled. "But I will rescue on that day, declares the Lord. You will not be handed over to those you fear. I will save you. You will not fall by the sword, but will escape with your life because you trust in me, declares the Lord." Now God tells Jeremiah in verse 15 to go and talk to Abed-Melech the Cushite. How could Jeremiah do that? He was confined in the courtyard of the guard. The prison there, well, it's either by letter or by word of mouth. He got word to Abed-Melech the Cushite. Now, this is the same Abed-Melech the Cushite who got Jeremiah out of the cistern earlier in the last chapter, as a matter of fact. And so this prophecy was after that, because Jeremiah is not in the cistern anymore. He's in the courtyard of the guard in the royal palace. This prophecy given to Abed-Melech must have been given right before the taking of the city in 586, and it was put here to show how God treats kindly those who treat prophets kindly, because Abed-Melech had treated Jeremiah very kindly. He had gotten Zedekiah to get Jeremiah out of the cistern where Jeremiah was going to die. We read that story in Jeremiah 38, verses 7 through 13. But Abed-Melech, a Cushite court official — Cushite means Ethiopian. A lot of times there were slaves from Ethiopia who served in royal courts. But Abed-Melech, a Cushite court official employed in the king's palace, heard Jeremiah had been put into the cistern. While the king was sitting at the Benjamin Gate, Abed-Melech went from the king's palace and spoke to the king. "My lord the king, these men have been evil in all they have done to Jeremiah the prophet. They have dropped him into the cistern where he will die from hunger, because there is no more bread in the city." So the king commanded Abed-Melech the Cushite, "Take from here 30 men under your authority and pull Jeremiah the prophet up from the cistern before he dies." So Abed-Melech took the men under his authority and went to the king's palace to a place below the storehouse. From there he took old rags and worn-out clothes and lowered them by ropes to Jeremiah in the cistern. Abed-Melech the Cushite cried out to Jeremiah, "Place these old rags and clothes between your armpits and the ropes." Jeremiah did so, and they pulled him up with the ropes and lifted him out of the cistern. But he continued to stay in the guard's courtyard. So Jeremiah delivers the prophecy to Abed-Melech the Cushite. God says, "I will rescue you on that day." And that's good news, because Abed-Melech the Cushite was working for Zedekiah, and Zedekiah was getting ready to be blinded and taken off into captivity. And I'm sure the Babylonian government would not take kindly to those who had worked for Zedekiah. But God says that Abed-Melech is going to be rescued. He will not be handed over to those who fear, despite the fact that you would think that's what's going to happen to a court official of Zedekiah. Verse 18, I will save you. You will not fall by the sword. You will escape. Now, that is not told anywhere how that happened, but I'm sure it did because Jeremiah was one great prophet. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Jeremiah 39, and we are now prepared to go to Jeremiah 40, which I will entitle Jeremiah Remains in Judah. In other words, he didn't go to Babylon. He stayed in Judah. We'll take up the history in the next audio. I hope you stay tuned with me to listen to that, and I hope you enjoyed this chapter.